This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of November 14th, 2021. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 212. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. The Is It Just Me commentary. And, on the big deal feature, 4 years ago this month, the Breaker.News podcast launched. Hear highlights from the first four editions in November 2017, featuring Glenn Greenwald, Sean Holman, Dermot Travis, and Craig Jones. Four people known for questioning authority and speaking truth to power. Listen to the big deal feature to find out how. But first, is it just me? Is it just me, or is it high time for Vancouver Whitecaps owner Greg Kerfoot to break his silence? On November 13, 2002, Kerfoot bought the Vancouver Whitecaps and the Breakers women's team. Both were in the United Soccer League's semi-pro leagues. The Whitecaps' previous owner, David Standick, couldn't afford to operate the teams, so the league kept the teams on life support until Crystal Decision Software owner Kerfoot came to save pro soccer in Vancouver. After 19 years, Kerfoot has not sat down once for an interview with a reporter. He is so shy he even complained to the province newspaper after his photograph was printed once. It wasn't printed again. Don Garber, the MLS commissioner, told me once that Kerfoot is the most engaged owner. Former Whitecaps employees have told me he is a micromanager who even designed the logo. Yet, when it comes to the media, Kerfoot prefers to be a ghost. The Whitecaps men had more success before joining MLS. They won the 2006 and 2008 USL trophies. When he operated a women's team, they were 2004 and 2006 W League champs. The MLS era has been a failure so far. Seven coaches and only four playoff appearances in 10 years. Vancouver is the weak link in Cascadia, where the Seattle Sounders have two MLS Cups and the Portland Timbers one. They made Gambian Mustafa Jarju a designated player in 2011, but he didn't score once. They let 2013 MLS scoring champ, Brazilian Camilo Sanvezo, get away to a club in Mexico instead of paying the most exciting player what he deserved. There have been numerous scandals, including the revelations that two women's coaches, Bob Berarda and Hubert Busby Jr., were fired for sexually harassing players. Berarda is facing criminal charges. MLS had enough and has hired a Toronto law firm to look into the past of the women's program. There are serious questions about what Bob and Dan Leonarduzzi, Greg Anderson, and Rachel Lewis knew and when they knew it. The investigation will not be complete, however, without former chair John Furlong and Kerfoot himself being put on the hot seat. Who knew what and when? Vancouver sports fans don't want a walking, talking ego like Jerry Jones or Mark Cuban. They just want someone who is as humbly passionate as they are. Someone dedicated to making this team a winner. Someone who can put his face and voice behind the team that so many people have paid so much of their hard-earned money to support. Is that person Kerfoot? Will he ever change? Or will he sell the team? What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. This is the big deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. 4 years ago this month, the Breaker.News podcast launched. Hear highlights from the first four editions in order of appearance. From November 5th, 2017, the reporter who introduced the world to whistleblower Edward Snowden, Glenn Greenwald. From November 12th, 2017, journalism professor Sean Holman on whether Canadians really have democracy. From November 19th, 2017, the late government watchdog Dermot Travis on campaign finance reform in BC. And from November 26th, 2017, Craig Jones, the UBC law student who was arrested for peacefully protesting the leader of China when he visited the APEC summit at UBC in 1997. This is the debut edition of the Breaker.News podcast for the 5th of November 2017. Welcome. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News.
The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues and institutions. It is a vehicle to stop secrecy, to unravel the spin, and to enable citizens to better scrutinize those who hold power and influence on the west coast of Canada and beyond. I hope you'll tune in weekly and tell your friends, your enemies too, about TheBreaker.News. The big deal feature on the first edition of TheBreaker.News podcast was the speech by The Intercept's Glenn Greenwald at the Allard Prize Awards at the University of British Columbia.
So when I first started talking to Edward Snowden, it was late 2012, and he contacted me via the internet. And we ended up speaking for many weeks, during which I had no information at all, no knowledge whatsoever about who he was. He was telling me, and then he had demonstrated to me, that he had taken extremely sensitive documents from the most secretive agency within the world's most powerful government, which he said he wanted to share with me. And he then demonstrated that he had those. But I didn't know his name. I didn't know where he worked. I didn't know anything about him personally. I didn't know his age. I knew nothing. And in the very first conversation, the very first one that I ever had with him, he said, look, I want to give you these materials because I know that the world needs to see them. And I think you're the person who can deliver them in a way that will be effective. And I started to talk to him about ways that I could shield his anonymity to protect the government, to protect him from having the government discover who he was. And he said, no, you don't understand. I don't want anonymity.
This week, the Breaker.News podcast features award-winning investigative journalist Sean Holman. Holman founded Public Eye Online and produced the TV documentary Whipped, The Secret World of Party Discipline. He is now an associate professor of journalism in Calgary at Mount Royal University. On September 21st in Vancouver, Holman spoke about the state of freedom of information and democracy at the BC Information Summit. The one-day event was hosted by the BC Freedom of Information and Privacy Association at the University of British Columbia's Robson Square campus.
What do I mean by secret by default? Well, there are five interrelated traditions that we inherited from Brits and then we burnished as Canadians that make up this secret by default system. And it starts at the very top. As all of you know, the ultimate decision-making body in government is cabinet. And it functions according to the rule of cabinet confidentiality. In other words, everything that happens in it, in government's principal decision-making body, is secret. And this is in part to support the principle of cabinet solidarity, that everyone, once they have had a discussion in cabinet, agrees with that decision. And those people who don't agree with that decision must either remove themselves from cabinet or pretend, in other words, lie to the public, that they agree with that decision. And because of party discipline and because of cabinet solidarity, a government that has a majority in the legislature can essentially do whatever it wants and carry out those decisions without challenge. This creates an assumption, I think, that privacy is necessary for decision making. And this is further reinforced by ministerial responsibility, where regardless of whether or not the minister is acting on the advice of someone else or the decision of someone else, they take responsibility for that, which is then supported by civil service anonymity. So you have these five interlocking traditions that create a secret by default system. And we actually used to have a discussion about this in this country. D.F. Wall, who was a fairly well-known Privy Council office official, in a report on freedom of information for the PCO, called this the built-in confidentiality in Canadian politics. And yet, if you are feeling uncomfortable today in me raising these issues, in me talking about the fact that maybe we need to reconsider how our system of government functions if we actually want freedom of information, then maybe that's part of the problem. I think the BC Ombudsman said it quite well. Culture eats policy. Systems eat policy. And that's what's been happening for the past 30 plus years in this country. And until we have that conversation, until we have that conversation about our secret by default system, we are going to keep on having these conferences and keep on being frustrated about the lack of action when it comes to reforming freedom of information in this country.
That was Sean Holman speaking September 21st at the 2017 BC Information Summit. British Columbia was the Wild West of political campaign financing before the 2017 election. There were no limits to the dollar amounts and no limits to the sources of funds. But Dermot Travis helped make it the dominant issue of the 2017 election campaign. When the BC NDP and Green Alliance defeated the BC Liberals in a post-election confidence vote, one of their first orders of business in the fall session of the legislature was to ban corporate and union donations and to cap individual donations at $1,200 a year. They also brought in a direct taxpayer subsidy. But, as with any legislation, it is far from perfect. On the third edition of the Breaker.News podcast in November 19th, 2017, Dermot pointed to some of those gaps and loopholes.
In terms of the omission side, not only do you have the issue of how parties spend their money as being one of the omissions, I think that they missed one, a golden opportunity to reduce the disclosure requirements in the legislation. Currently, only donors over $250 are disclosed. That has not been changed in the new legislation. Even the Liberal Party proposed lowering it to $100. I think that they've made a mistake in that, and I think they've made a mistake in not adding on what information should now be collected about contributors. And the most important piece of information that needs to be collected about contributors is who is your employer? Because one lesson from other jurisdictions that have banned corporate and union donations is some companies in particular that have tried to use their employees or a list of what are called in Quebec straw men to make political donations on their behalf, and that they are then reimbursed. But it is very much corporate money. SNC-Lavalin recently accepted the ruling of Elections Canada in this regard, that they, in fact, had done that practice for a number of years at the federal level after corporate donations had been banned in the federal arena.
On the big deal this week, it was November 25th, 1997. The University of British Columbia campus on Point Grey in Vancouver was teeming with police. Prime Minister Jean Chrétien hosted 18 leaders at the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit. The eyes of the world were on Vancouver, and students were not happy to welcome Indonesian dictator Suharto or Chinese President Jiang Zemin to their campus. It was only 8 years since the Chinese government cracked down on student protests in Tiananmen Square, while the world was watching in shock. More than 2,500 people protested, and many were pepper-sprayed by RCMP officers. Police made 48 arrests. You may remember this arrogant and ignorant Chrétien answer to Nardwuar the Human Serviette on that day.
What do you see?
Some of the protesters were maced. Does mace equal freedom? Would you have been maced yourself back then, Prime Minister Chrétien?
But I don't know what you mean by that.
A mace? Pepper spray, some other members.
Oh, but I don't know. This technique did not exist in those days. For me, pepper, I put it on my plate. Next.
A public inquiry later found that police were under pressure from the Prime Minister's office and they violated the protesters' civil rights. One of them was law student Craig Jones, who innocently placed paper signs on security fences. Jones graduated from UBC in 1998, got a master's degree at Harvard in 2002, and worked as a constitutional lawyer in the BC government. He is a former president of the BC Civil Liberties Association. He spoke to The Breaker from Kamloops 20 years after APEC 97. Talk about that day. What was going through your mind on November 25th, 1997, when you were on campus and decided to express your opinion when leaders of the world and world media were here in Vancouver?
Me and a few of my fellow students had become concerned with the sort of police crackdown on the protesters to that point. And we had a privileged position in that we lived right beside the motorcade route. And so we just decided to erect a few signs along the route. Democracy, said one, I think, free speech and human rights, fairly, I thought, innocuous statements. Anyway, when we did that, the police who were manning the sort of nearby checkpoints became very concerned and first asked us to move the signs, and we did, and then they said, well, we couldn't have them there at all, and that's when the argument ensued that ended up with me as the meat in an RCMP sandwich, and I was, I think I was the first person arrested that day. This all happened very early in the morning, and then later that day, of course, there were the much larger protests and the pepper spray incidents and the things that, were broadcast immediately on the television. And then, you know, over the period of the next few years, actually, I think it took 4 years for the inquiry decision to come down. We fought to establish some limits on the political suppression of protests. It came out in the context of the inquiry, when all of the government documents were revealed that the Prime Minister's office had actually directed the RCMP to arrest certain students, and it was really all very unseemly. In a way, kind of gratifying to participate in that process. I was quite struck by how offended Canadians seemed to be by what happened, and how willing they were to, set up a process to figure out exactly what happened and see what they could do to correct it.
Those were highlights from the first four editions of the Breaker.News podcast in November 2017, 4 years ago this month. You can hear the full editions on the Breaker.News podcast archive.
News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In my Nietzsche news, Japan opts to secure COVID oral medicine for 1.6 million people. In preparation for a potential sixth wave of coronavirus infections in Japan, the government has agreed with U.S. pharmaceutical company Merck on the procurement of molnupiravir, an orally administered drug that prevents the virus from entering or multiplying in the body. During the peak of the nation's fifth wave last summer, around 28,000 people were hospitalized. Japan plans to increase capacity by the end of November to accommodate 37,000 patients. In Hong Kong Free Press, nearly 6 years jail for Hong Konger who incited secession with pro-independence chants and slogans. Ma Chen-man was said to have a layered plan to incite other people to seize Hong Kong's sovereignty from the hands of China, the judge ruled. Former food delivery worker Ma, better known as Captain America 2.0, is the second person jailed under the Beijing-imposed national security law and the first to be convicted for acts involving only speech. In the New Zealand Herald, online videos show youngsters bus surfing. Auckland Transport slams behavior. Video posted to TikTok shows young men riding on top of buses and cars, as well as walking on the edge of skyscrapers and plunging down the slopes of Auckland's volcanic Maunga on bicycles. Auckland Transport slammed the risky behavior. A spokesperson told the Herald, quote, "This behavior is obviously extremely dangerous and just totally unacceptable," end quote. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In KDRV, jockeys injured after lights go out during race at Grants Pass Downs. The incident happened during the 11th and final race on November 9th. The gates opened and the horses came charging out into the initial stretch of the 6.5-furlong race. Then the track was suddenly plunged into darkness. When the first horses reappeared under the light of a scoreboard across from the stands, two of them were without riders. In King 5, effort underway to fix supply chain issues at West Coast ports. The Northwest Seaport Alliance says that a container shipped to Seattle that cost $2,000 in 2019 can cost as much as $20,000 now. Many empty containers are being stacked in whatever free space can be found, including Port of Seattle's Terminal 46, which, until a few months ago, was sitting empty in preparation for being turned into a place to handle cruise ships. Now empty containers are stacked high, along with parts of Terminal 5 in West Seattle. In Czech news, 105 containers that fell off cargo ship believed to have sunk, says Coast Guard. The Coast Guard says in a statement that four containers carrying fridges and running shoes washed ashore on northern Vancouver Island, but there is no sign of the others. The containers were tossed from the MV Zim Kingston during a storm near the entrance to the Juan de Fuca Strait around the time a fire broke out on the vessel. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to Métis British Columbians for keeping their Aboriginal culture alive. November 16th is Louis Riel Day in BC, commemorating the 136th anniversary of his death. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca.
Vaccine, because once you're dead, then that's a bit too late. I know I'm trying to be funny now, but I'm dead serious about the vaccine. I think we all want to get back to normal, whatever that is, and that would be a great shot in the arm, wouldn't it?
That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of November 14th, 2021. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on November 14th in 1938, the Lionsgate Bridge, which connects Vancouver and the North Shore, opened? The three-lane bridge with a 473-meter span took just over a year to build. Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.